Thank you so much, Jennifer, and good evening, everyone. I really enjoyed today's proceedings. It's one of the more professional and diverse discussions on these subjects I've ever experienced, and I hope I can add to that for you this evening. There's the cover of my book, You Will Perish in Flames, They Say. It's funny because we're actually in one of the coldest periods of the Earth's history right now. It's called the Pleistocene Ice Age. We're in an interglacial period, but it's still one of the coldest periods in Earth's history, and yet they're claiming it's going to get too hot. This is where I was born. This is 1952. This picture was taken. I lived in that home on that floating logging camp on the northwest tip of Vancouver Island, where there was no road. The road finally came in 65, and we thought, wow, this place is going to boom. Half the people use the road to get out. I was sent off to boarding school in Vancouver, where I soon learned city ways, enrolling in a Bachelor of Science in Forestry and Biology, and then a PhD in Ecology. This was the height of the Cold War, the height of the Vietnam War, and the beginning of the emerging consciousness of the environment. The word ecology had not yet been used in the popular press, but environment was now becoming prominent. Here I am on my way. I can't seem to get it to go that way anymore. I'm on my way to Alaska on a boat to protest U.S. hydrogen bomb testings. Here we are on that boat. That's the sail of the boat in the background. We're standing, sitting on whatever you call that thing below the sail. And that's me under the pea in 1971. We look like a bunch of hippies. Well, it was the hippie era, but everyone in that photograph is actually a professional of one sort or another, either in early or later in their career, in engineering, in law, in myself in life science, and doctors and lawyers, and you know, we all knew what we were doing. We stopped those nuclear tests in Alaska were stopped by President Nixon the following year, partly because of what we did. We had tens of thousands of people marching in the streets of the United States and Canada, joining arms at the border the day the bomb went off, closing every border crossing between the United States and Canada that day. That got people's attention, and President Nixon canceled the remaining H-bomb tests. We went on. This is French atmospheric nuclear testing in the South Pacific. So in 1972 and 73, we sailed boats into the test site at Mururoa Atoll in French Polynesia. And to make a long story short, France stopped atmospheric nuclear testing in the South Pacific in 1974, and it never happened again. They continued to test underground for some years after, but they were not sending radiation all around the Southern Hemisphere ever again. This is me driving a rubber boat with my friend Fred into the first encounter with the Soviet factory whaling fleet in the North Pacific in 1975. We conducted 4 years of voyages into the Pacific. I was on all of them, the leader of the final two, the navigator of all of them, from Vancouver to San Francisco to Hawaii and into the far North Pacific near Alaska. And we stopped the killing of 30,000 large whales every year by Russian and Japanese whalers. It took 4 years, and in 1981, factory whaling was banned in the entire world. And whereas we were not the only players in the campaign to stop nuclear testing in Alaska by the U.S., we ended up being the main force against the French atmospheric testing, and we were definitely the leaders of this campaign, because the fellow who was studying the first captive whale got fired for various reasons. It's a long story. You can read my book, Confessions of a Greenpeace Dropout. But he came to us and said, you guys are the only ones who know how to go out in boats. We got to go out and get in front of the harpoons and stop the whalers from killing the whales and bring the footage back. And when we did, it went worldwide. What we called, well, it was viral, basically. And it went worldwide, and that's when Greenpeace became famous all around the world for stopping the killing of, these are the fleeing whales that we were following in front of the Harpoon. Here I am sitting on a baby seal off the east coast of Canada. They were killing 250,000 pups, still nursing at their mother's breast. You don't do that with mammals. And I should have that clip in here. I never saw anything so distressing as the mother seal coming back after its cub was clubbed and skinned, after it had been chased away by hitting it with the club. It came back and put its chest over the skinned pup and cried. It actually, I mean, mammals can cry. And these mother seals were crying. It was not about endangered species. This was about basically morality. And we ended that. It took 4 years to do it. Why did I leave Greenpeace after 15 years? The overall philosophical reason was because the green was all that was left. The peace had been dropped. We had a strong humanitarian orientation in order to end nuclear war, to save civilization, in other words, people, from being destroyed. But as time went on, just because of the evolution of the situation, I don't know what, they lost that. And now humans were being described as the enemies of nature, the enemies of the earth. And I know as an ecologist that humans are part of nature, came from nature, and are no more not part of nature than any other species. And that it is wrong to tell our children that we are separate from the rest of nature, as in a philosophical and even, you could even say, in a religious sort of way. They are peddling junk science for donations today. And the real tip of the spear, though, was I was the only director of Greenpeace International, there were six of us, who had any formal science education. My fellow directors, because chlorine can be toxic, and because DDT and PCBs and other chlorinated hydrocarbons were the target, they just said, well, chlorine is the common denominator. Let's have a campaign to ban chlorine worldwide. I tried my best to convince them first. I said, like, chlorine is one of the elements in the periodic table, you guys. It is actually the 11th most abundant element in the Earth's crust. But more importantly, it is also, using chlorine compounds was the most important advance in public health in history, putting it in drinking water, swimming pools and spas, etc. And not only that, our medications are 85%, our pharmaceuticals are made 85% with chlorine chemistry, and 25% of them actually have chlorine in them. And so I just could not stay, so I had to leave, because they were going that way. This is where I live today. That's the view from our balcony in Comox, British Columbia, Vancouver Island, taken about 2 months ago. The snow is now finally leaving the mountains, but it's still on the tops. That's the Comox Glacier on the left there. It is one of the most beautiful estuaries in the world. This is an estuary of the Comox River where there are so many thousands of wildlife, of sea lions and whales and ducks and geese and swans. You would not believe it. Anyways, into the real thing. I realized some couple of years ago that all the scare stories are based on things that are either invisible, that's why I say fake invisible catastrophes, or so remote that no one can see it for themselves. That's why coral reefs and polar bears are the icons that are used to scare people about climate change. Because very few people can go and look at the whole Great Barrier Reef, and very few people can go and look at all the polar bears around the Arctic Circle. In physics, there's this unified field theory idea that where someday all the things in physics, like gravity and light and electricity and everything, will be put into one formula. It's probably a pipe dream. But this is no pipe dream. This unified theory of scare stories is true. And going through here now, I will show you why it is true. This is a 500 million years and more of global temperature and CO2 concentration in the atmosphere. The blue line is temperature, The purple line is CO2. This gives you a slightly negative correlation. There is not a positive correlation between CO2 and temperature over the long-term history, and this is only the last half billion years. There were 3.5 more billion years before that, or three billion years where there was life before that. But if you'll notice, for example, the first little oval red thing, that's the Silurian ice age. There was an ice age when CO2 was at approximately 5,000 ppm, more than 10 times what it is today. Then the next one, the Karoo ice age, in the Carboniferous period, coincided with a drop in CO2, but the Carboniferous period was when forests formed. And this resulted in at least an order of magnitude more carbon in biological systems. When the forests grew, before that, everything was flat on the ground or in the ocean. And when forests grew, they sucked a huge amount of carbon out of the atmosphere. Now, why that CO2 depletion continued is too long a story for here, but I think it had to do with the fact that there was no enzyme that could dissolve, could digest lignin, and it took until an enzyme named Mycetes, I think, something like that, figured out how to digest lignin, and then CO2 went back up again because all the dead trees ended up being eaten by these funguses. It's far-fetched sounding, but nobody else has an explanation for it. Look at the big red circle. This is 200 million years. That ice age, the Karoo, lasted for 100 million years. It's a logarithmic scale showing when you get closer to the present, it stretches out more, so you can see what's happened closer to the present. But that is 200 million years, where CO2 and temperature were totally out of sync with each other. When CO2 goes up, temperature comes down. When temperature goes up, CO2 comes down. And CO2 has been coming down now steadily for 150 million years. There's a reason for that. And if you look at the very tail end, on the right-hand side, that little uptick is all we have done. We have not done more than that, but we have at least done that, which has ended the constant downward trend in CO2 in the global atmosphere. CO2 being the main carbon source for all life, in fact, the only carbon source for all life. And it went from 6,000 parts per million to, you'll see soon, 180,000 parts per million not that long ago. Here's the graph showing the present level of CO2, which we have created. It went down to 180 in the last glacial maximum, and the death of plants occurs at 150. So we came along just in time to reverse the constant downward trend of CO2. In other words, we have restored a balance somewhat to the global carbon cycle. We are the salvation of life, not its destroyer. Why did CO2 decline so precipitously for so many million years? These guys, marine calcifying species, all of which learned half a billion years ago from many different phyla to make armor plating for their soft bodies out of calcium carbonate. The carbonate comes from CO2. The calcium comes from calcium dissolved in the water, from the rocks on the land with erosion into the sea. So they took those two things and made this armor plating just like a knight in armor put on steel to protect their soft bodies. It was a brilliant innovation, but it resulted in the continuous removal of CO2 from the oceans, which came from the atmosphere, but as the CO2 went down in the oceans, the equilibrium between the atmosphere and the oceans caused the CO2 to come out of the atmosphere into the oceans, and constantly down and down and down. 100 million billion tons of carbon, all of which came from CO2, are locked into carbonaceous rocks, limestone, marble, and chalk. The White Hills of Dover are the skeletons of the little coccolithophores on the left. They are microscopic plankton, phytoplankton. The foraminifera on the right, the holes in those, the holes in those gratings are just the right size for a coccolithophore to go in. They eat the coccolithophores. Then up the food chain it goes. Coral reefs are responsible for about 50% of the sedimentation, the sequestration. You talk about sequestration, they're saying they're going to bury the CO2 from the coal plants in the ground. These guys have been burying CO2 for a long, long time, way more than we could ever do, and it's stupid to do it anyways, because raising the CO2 up another double or triple times would be good for life. This is the last 65 million years since the dinosaur extinction. The Eocene thermal maximum, which you saw here at the very peak there on the right. So I'm showing you now that last 50 million years of cooling. We are at the tail end of a 50 million year cooling period in this Earth. There's no question of this. This is absolutely true. At the tail end there, where you see Pleistocene Ice Age on the right, that is where we are now in global temperature. Nobody talks about anything before about 1850. They don't want to talk about a million years ago or 10 million years ago or 50 million years ago. It doesn't fit their narrative because this is a fact. Here's the last 5.5 million years as the climate descended into the Pleistocene Ice Age, which is arbitrarily designated at 2.6 million years ago. Note how many cycles there have been in the Pleistocene. People are fooled into thinking that the end of the most recent major glaciation, glacial advance, was the end of the Ice Age. The Ice Age has had over 40 of those, beginning with 41,000-year cycles and now 100,000-year cycles. The switch is called the Pleistocene Conundrum. Nobody knows why it's changed from the tilt of the Earth Milankovitch cycle to the 100,000-year orbit of the Earth's eccentricity cycle. I could go into the Milankovitch cycle. It's caused by the gravitational effect of Jupiter, and it is causing these cycles. Note that the coldest periods are occurring recently. The Pleistocene may well be getting colder. The Karoo lasted 100 million years. Our ice age has lasted 2.5 million years. It's thought the tectonic plates floating around and jumping into each other and pulling apart like Africa and South America did, and the ocean currents may well be the reason these ice ages have set on and last for so many million years. We don't know the answer to that. It's always important to know what you don't know. This is the last 400,000 years. These are the four interglacial periods on the top, the height, and the four glacial maximums on the bottom. You will note that it takes 80,000 years to go from the interglacial period into the glacial maximum and only 10,000 years to come back out of it. This is in the Milankovitch cycle. Al Gore said, it's obvious because CO2 and temperature are so strongly correlated that CO2 must be the cause of the temperature increase. How would the gravity of Jupiter and the Milankovitch cycles changing the tilt of the Earth and the shape of the orbit affect CO2? No, that affects temperature. And when the oceans warm, they give off CO2, and when the oceans cool, they absorb CO2. It's a simple formula. We all know that if you take a glass of water out of the fridge and put it on your counter, bubbles form on the inside of the glass. That's the gases coming out. You put it back in the fridge, the bubbles disappear. So Al Gore had it exactly backwards. The cause here is the temperature warming the oceans. 800,000, there's an 800-year lag in this Vostok ice core record, 800-year lag between the temperature changing and the CO2 changing. And the effect never comes before the cause. So this is pretty much solid, rock-solid stuff. It's temperature. Look where the CO2 has gone. I'm sorry I can't use my pointer effectively. I wish I was able to. But see where it says at the very end there, the year 2020, we're at 415. Now it's 420 ppm. The temperature has not followed the CO2 up because the temperature is, the CO2 is going up because of our emissions, but it is not causing the temperature to go up. Okay, coming even closer to the present, as you'll notice, I just keep coming closer to the present. This is the last 6,000 years or so of the Holocene interglacial period that we are in now. So yes, the temperature is going up now. It has been since 1700, when the Little Ice Age came to its lowest temperature. But it has been cooling in fits and starts. There's cycles on cycles, and these are thousand-year cycles between the Minoan, the Roman, and the medieval warm period, and there's been cooling periods after each one of those, the Little Ice Age being the coldest one of all, and now we're in an upward trend. But there's no evidence that it's actually caused by our CO2 emissions. Here's one that really demonstrates that. The red line is the longest recorded temperature record with a thermometer from central England. And the black line is our annual CO2 emissions. There's no way that the temperature is responding to the CO2 emissions in an exponential fashion. It's been going up since 1700. And if you will note, if you can see it there, on the left-hand side, you see a very low temperature close to the left-hand side, and then an upward trend. That trend is longer and more than anything that has ever happened since. And we were not even emitting CO2 into the atmosphere at that time. So it just shows you very clearly that the temperature curve is not correlated strongly or in even any way with the CO2 curve. Okay, let's get into some really fun stuff here. The claim is that polar bears will become extinct due to climate change, when the fact is polar bears would not exist if it weren't for climate change. Climate change is the reason polar bears exist. As the Earth cooled over the last 50 million years, around 3 million years ago, the Arctic started to freeze over in the winters. Prior to that, there'd been no ice in the Arctic for 250 million years. The polar bear evolved from the Eurasian brown bear, which we call the grizzly bear. It came here across the land bridge like people did during a glacial maximum. We don't know which one. It may have been the one we came across, the most recent one, or it may have been a previous one. But polar bears evolved much earlier than that from the Eurasian brown bear. When ice started to cover the Arctic in significant amount, the Eurasian brown bear went out onto the ice and found that it could hunt seals. But it made sense for the Eurasian brown bear to become white in the Arctic, to become larger, to be strong enough to pull these very big fat seals out of their breathing holes, and to develop a different digestive system that was more for carnivorous, whereas the brown bear ate a lot of berries, just like bears do all over the place where there's berries. So this is how the polar bear came into existence. And it probably took about 500,000 years during this Pleistocene ice age for the polar bear to evolve from the Eurasian brown bear. So no, climate change does not threaten the polar bear with extinction, and the polar bear would not exist if it weren't for climate change. National Geographic, 2017. This is what climate change looks like. This is a dying old polar bear, probably lost all its teeth by now. But the main cause of death in polar bears is starvation, because they can't hunt anymore and they can't chew anymore, and there are no nursing homes for old polar bears. And even at this stage of their dying, they can swat away anything that would come anywhere near them, even a people. They could just go whack and take your face off, right? So they're not going to be killed by something before they die of starvation. That is what happens. And it took them 9 months in National Geographic to slightly own up to the fact that this was malarkey. They always show you the picture on the bottom right when they show you Arctic ice. That is the minimum extent of Arctic ice in the summer when there's 24 hours of sunlight for 6 months. So at the end of that 6 months, that's what you get. The picture on the upper left is the winter, the most recent winter, showing that the ice not only covers every square inch of the Arctic Ocean still today, but also spreads much further to Hudson Bay, inside Greenland, inside the Beaufort Sea. This is what's happening right now. It has not stopped covering the whole Arctic Ocean. And the food chain diagram below shows that the good thing about there being ocean exposed in the summer is that the sun can reach the surface of the sea, promote plankton, which promotes zooplankton, which promotes fish, which promotes seals, which promotes polar bears. How many of you have heard of the international treaty that was signed by all five Arctic nations in 1973 to end the unrestricted hunting of polar bears? 2, 3, 4, 5. They never tell you that. You have to have figured that out yourself or seen it somehow, but the media is never going to tell you that. Wildlife biologists came to the governments of those countries and said, rich people are coming up here in charter planes and hiring Inuit guides and getting some fireplace rugs. And the population is declining. Since then, the population has increased by 4 to 5 times to today, 50 years. Here is the statistics. 1973 population, 6 to 8,000. 2020 population, 30 to 50,000. These are the numbers from the people who are counting them. And so what do the polar bear activists, scare story people say now? They'll be extinct by 2200, something? I forget now. 2100. That thing. 70 years from now, they'll be extinct. That's what they say, as if they have some kind of crystal ball, when in fact they're growing really well. Here's what the Inuit people, Nunavut is the name of the treeless area of Canada in the northeast, including Baffin Island and northern Quebec, where there's no trees. That's where the polar bears are. The Nunavut people have a government in Iqaluit, which is in the south of Baffin Island, and they have passed a polar bear management plan 2 years ago because there's too many bears. They're breaking into their houses and killing their people. The media did not cover this in Canada and the United States, that the Inuit thought there was too many polar bears and they passed a polar bear management plan allowing people to defend themselves from polar bears. The only place it was reported was in a town in Nunavut of 1,600 people. The many millions of people didn't hear about this any more than they heard about the 1973 treaty, which has been enforced thoroughly since then. That's why there's 30 to 50,000 polar bears now. Okie doke, we come to the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. This is one of my favorites. If there's anything that's remote, it is the middle of the Pacific Ocean. This one says there's actually two great Pacific garbage patches. But this is a fake image. This isn't a photograph. It's just an internet fake image. Here's another one. Looks like the Great Pacific Garbage Patch is actually pretty near as big as the lower 48 states. And another one. A new continent, Plastic Nation, has emerged and threatens to kill the oceans in less than 10 years. With plastic, it's going to kill the oceans? Why do we put all our food in plastic? To keep it safe from contamination. That's why. Because it's non-toxic. That's why. Does it suddenly become toxic when it goes in the ocean? Of course not. Yet this is what they tell people. Well, how about this? Now, there is part of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, it says below. This is actually what happened when the Japanese earthquake killed 20,000 people in a tsunami and sent towns into the sea in rubble. This is not the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, but they portray it as such. Here's the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. This is a German satellite composite photo taken over a year of the whole Pacific Ocean. I think you can see Hawaii there. It's not twice the size of Texas. There is no Great Pacific Garbage Patch. It is non-existent. And this is what really is going on. Fishermen are throwing discarded gear that is damaged overboard. It took 48 days between California and Hawaii to get this much stuff. It would be easy to solve this problem if the environmental community met with the international fishing community and tried to figure out how to get them not to do that. Now, it's not easy because fishing boats only have so much room on them, and they want to save the room for fish and ice and stuff that they need. They don't need damaged nets and gear. So, but there's got to be a solution to this if you want to bother with it. But let me explain a little bit. Like, nets are not a good thing because they can catch fish while they're drifting in the ocean and no one gets to eat the fish and the fish die because they get caught. So that would be a good reason to at least make sure nets, which are meant to catch fish, are not thrown in the ocean. But this is not a Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Greenpeace says this crab is trapped in the cup. No, it's using it for habitat, for shelter. That's why it's in there. The reason plastic is different from driftwood, which everybody thinks is fine, all this driftwood floating around in the ocean, it provides habitat too, but it isn't shaped like a cup or a bottle that has an opening in it that a fish can go in and hide and be protected. So plastic actually offers more opportunity for biodiversity in the ocean than wood does. And it's not toxic. It is the opposite. I took this picture on a beach near my place in Winter Harbor. These are pelagic gooseneck barnacles. They love that plastic float because they can attach themselves to it and float around the ocean for a few months and then wash up on the beach. What's wrong with that? Here's my least favorite person. David Attenborough, in his BBC series, claims that adult albatross are feeding plastic to their chicks, mistaking it for food. Here's one of his gang showing a plastic bag that she claims was fed to a chick and then regurgitated later. Albatross feed solid objects to their chicks just like all land birds do, but they use pebbles. It's easy to find pebbles on the land, but there's no pebbles in the ocean. So ocean birds have to use other hard objects to feed to the gizzard as a digestive aid. All birds do this. They have no teeth, so they can't chew their food like mammals can. So they swallow their food whole. And the hard parts of their food go to the gizzard. The soft parts go to a normal stomach like we have. So they have two different stomachs. An albatross would never feed a plastic bag to their chicks. Only they show this. These are all items that were regurgitated. The chicks can have a lot more stuff in their gizzard when they're in their nest because they don't have to fly. Before they fledge, they barf up most of it. But they're pretending this is it, this glove on the right there. Albatrosses don't feed things like that to their chicks. This is the kind of thing they give their chicks. You can see that these bits of hard plastic have been very selectively chosen from the sea. And these bits of hard plastic are the same as giving them squid beaks. When albatross feed their chicks squid, the beak is retained after the squid is digested to act as part of the grinding mechanism for the hard bits of food. And they feed them hard bits of wood that are the right size. They feed them pumice after there's been an undersea volcano. They really like that because it's abrasive, and in the right size, it's a really good thing. All these things wear out in the gizzard eventually because they're grinding in there. So they have to keep, all adult albatross and other seabirds have to keep ingesting hard objects all their lives, just like land birds do. But this is not a plastic bag, and this is not a big plastic glove being fed to the chick. That is a lie. No, albatross are not that stupid. They know what they are doing when they feed these bits of plastic to their chick. 60 years they've been doing this. The albatross population, I should have put the graph in here, has grown exponentially since 1900 when they ended the feather trade. It used to be that people went out to the islands where seabirds were and killed them and stole all their feathers for ladies' hats and stuff. And that ended, and the seabird population in all these islands has extremely increased since that time. So this is said to be on the internet the plastic that was in the gizzard of a albatross chick. Their gizzards are not that big. This is totally staged, and it's all over the internet. Totally staged. That sharp pink thing in the middle there, they would never feed that to their chick because it could pierce the lining of their gizzard. They feed them things which are smooth and small. This is a big change of pace here. Everywhere in the world, garbage is produced. Municipal solid waste, as they euphemistically call it. Much of it can be recycled. All the glass can be recycled. All the metals can be recycled. That's no problem. But the combustible materials, plastic, paper, and wood, only some of them can be recycled. United States and Canada each put more than 50% of their municipal solid waste into landfills. In other words, dumps. Nothing good is done with them. Waste to energy plants, there's one in Minneapolis, St. Paul, there's one on Long Island, and there's a few others in the U.S. But in the U.S., they're very rare because the Greens are against burning things. They're actually against fire. If you analyze what they're against fire, which was the very beginning of human civilization, as far as I know, right? But what they do in Europe, there are over 700 of these waste-to-energy plants, state-of-the-art pollution control, taking the combustible waste, wood, paper, and plastic that is not suitable for recycling to make energy, and 4% of all their electricity in the EU comes from waste-to-energy plants. Here is going from Western Europe to Eastern Europe, from the left to right. Note that in many of the Western European countries, they basically use all their combustible waste, either recycling the green or waste to energy, the orange. As you move more into the Eastern European countries, the landfills in the red go up. There is no reason why they couldn't do exactly the same thing that the advanced Western countries, Sweden, Finland, Norway, Germany, France, etc., are doing. And there's no reason why we couldn't do that too and get some use out of this stuff that we dump on the land and bury. One of the reasons for this is that land is expensive in Western Europe, and therefore it makes more sense to do this, but it's also because people are more enlightened and decide to do this. Here's the biggest waste energy plant in the world being built in China right now, 168 megawatts. So about, you know, compared to a big nuclear plant, they're about, close to 20% more than that, 20% of a big nuclear plant from one facility. I won't spend long on this. I wish I could because I have a long story to tell, but it's a whole presentation in itself. GMOs. Speaking of fake invisible catastrophes, what is the bad thing in GMOs? They're saying there is. Why wouldn't you eat them if there wasn't something bad in them? Why, I don't know if I said that right, but you know what I mean. The reason they can't tell us what's the bad thing is because it doesn't exist. It's not only invisible. It doesn't have a name. Everything has a name, if we know about it. Everything has a chemical formula, even if it's complicated. There is no name for the bad thing in GMOs, and if you get into a debate with these people, eventually they just go, Monsanto! As if that's the bad thing in GMOs. That's the end of that discussion. Coral reefs around the world are dying, they say. Coral reefs are largely invisible and remote. Okay, this is what started in 2016. And then we wept. Scientists say 93% of the Great Barrier Reef now bleached. 93% of the Great Barrier Reef is practically dead. Study. Over 90% of the Great Barrier Reef suffered from coral bleaching. You may note that none of these say that the reef is dead. The word dead is not used. Dying is not dead. Bleached is not dead. Practically dying or whatever is not dead. Then the next year, the Great Barrier Reef is now terminal. Great Barrier Reef at terminal stage. Scientists despair at latest coral bleaching data. The Great Barrier Reef is in its final terminal stage, as if there are other terminal stages before the final one. How many, I wonder? And terminal does not mean dead either. It means we're predicting you're going to be dead. Doesn't mean you are. So this is what they get away with. Oh, suddenly in 2018, Great Barrier Reef definitely not dead. Great Barrier Reef showing, quote, signs of recovery, as if they don't really want to say it. Coral reefs show remarkable ability to cover from near death. Well, this is bleached coral. Bleaching is a perfectly natural phase in the coral life cycle. Because the animals are translucent, they are a relative of jellyfish, and you know the jellyfish you can see through, that's what they're like. And there's hundreds of thousands of them in every little teeny hole in that calcium carbonate skeleton. They all knew at the same time to eject their phytoplankton, which is what gives them the color. Coral reefs are a symbiotic organism where there's an animal and a plant. The plant is the phytoplankton. It makes sugar for the coral animal, and the animal gives them shelter under their skin. They have very thin skin, so the sunlight can go through their skin and photosynthesize and give food to the corals. But every once in a while, when environmental conditions change, either cold or hot, we don't even know why they do it. They just eject all their phytoplankton, and later on, they bring it back again, very often a different species of phytoplankton. They all know which phytoplankton species to absorb as well as to eject. So somehow, that structure, which has tens or hundreds of thousands of coral polyps, the animal, in it, can tell each other which species of phytoplankton they're going to absorb next. Bleaching of coral is not like pouring bleach on your clothes. It is not like the bleaching of the sun, causing wood to bleach. It is a completely different phenomenon. And so they use this word bleaching. Now, you would think that scientists and environmental reporters might know what I just told you. But they pretend that they don't. The world's warmest seas are in the Coral Triangle. I'm sorry, I had to translate this into PowerPoint from whatever I have in my Apple. And the thing at the bottom there got screwed up. But I'll just tell you what's going on here. That triangle is the Indonesian shallow oceans at the equator. They are protected from the cold water from north and south, especially from Australia protecting them. They have the highest biodiversity of corals by far in the world, over 600 species. The only place where there are soft corals that wave in the sea. They don't have hard skeletons. They still have calcium carbonate, but it's not connected like a branch the way that the hard corals are. And it has the highest biodiversity of reef fish in the world, too. This is a sanctuary for the shrinking of coral reefs in the 50-million-year cooling period from the Eocene thermal maximum. Caribbean, 50 million years ago, had twice as many species of corals as it does today. But it's cooled. It is the second warmest ocean in the world, the Caribbean, protected by North and South America, north to south, from cold water. So how can you say then that warming the sea, warming the climate, was going to kill the coral, when the coral actually has demonstrated very clearly that it likes the warmest oceans in the world? I'm sorry, it cuts off the top of my slides, this system, but the top slide is all marine taxa, 13 phyla. Note that the coral reef area, the Indonesian area, is by far the highest biodiversity, 3,409 species in there. Note that coastal fishes are of highest biodiversity there. Note that corals are by far, this is the real clincher, they have shrunk into that area while the rest of the world's oceans cooled over the last, and we're in the Pleistocene Ice Age. That's why they shrunk to there. I don't think you need more proof than this. Yet the author of this paper allowed himself to say that I had interpreted his data incorrectly, somehow. He did these graphs. But he told a reporter that I had interpreted his data incorrectly. This is where I've been twice now with my wife Eileen to 10 to 14 day snorkeling excursions in the Coral Triangle. It is the most amazing thing you would ever see in your life. If you're not a snorkeler, or if you are a snorkeler, you should do this, because it will change your whole perception of life and the earth and biodiversity and color and everything else. It is just too amazing. The last sort of environmental point here, this is again our good friend Sir David Attenborough, claiming that walruses committed suicide because there wasn't enough ice. He did actually do that in one of his series. The fact is, a pack of polar bears, these are the polar bears, there's a small town on the north coast of Russia where this happened. And he knew it was the polar bears that had caused the walruses to fall to their death, because they were going to eat them alive. And this is the colony of polar bears where he says there wasn't enough ice. The north coast of Russia always becomes ice-free in the summer. Polar bears are a coastal species. They dig for clams in the mud. They can't dive further than 300 feet, so they can't be out in the deep sea. They can't follow the ice north as it melts. This is a designated walrus sanctuary, and David Attenborough said the only reason they went there is because there wasn't any ice. Why would it be called a walrus sanctuary then? They've been going there for hundreds of years, maybe thousands. But you see that cliff before the ones on the top? Polar bears have been protected, and so have walruses. And their population has just exploded in the Arctic Sea because of that. And now they can't even fit on their lower level there. So they went up, waddled up to the top, where they are now above a cliff. Attenborough said it was 80 feet high. It's actually more like 30 feet high. But the polar bears were coming from behind. Here's a showing that it is true that polar bears eat walruses. And this is the film crew filming the walruses falling off the cliff. Well, you can see out there, there's where they're feeding. They're feeding in less than 300 feet of water offshore. And he said they committed suicide. Okay, a little change of pace here. I'm getting closer to the end now. Nuclear energy is too dangerous and should be banned. This is the aftermath of the Chernobyl accident. The news about the Ukraine invasion is making it appear as though Chernobyl still has operating nuclear reactors on it. It does not. The last one closed in 2020, and they're mothballed. There's the big stainless steel dome that's been built over this to prevent any more radiation from getting out. The place is secure. This was a unique accident. Three Mile Island and Fukushima were meltdowns of the core due to loss of cooling water caused by the heat of the fission products that had been created during the reaction. It was not a nuclear explosion. This was a nuclear explosion. In other words, critical. It was a slow one in terms of atomic bombs, but it blew a 2,000-ton lid right off this reactor, killed one of the reactor operators, and 59 to 60 or so people died as a result of this, mostly firefighters who worked for 10 days to put the carbon moderator out to stop the fire in the carbon. There was this huge, like, I forget how much, 200 tons or something of pure carbon was burning in there and still sending radiation into the air from the core of the reactor. So some of them died because they were exposed to such high levels. But people who were in the outskirts, with the exception of 7 children that died from thyroid cancer from iodine-131 due to late diagnosis, they were already too far gone. They could have been diagnosed earlier and they would have survived, because most people do. If they get iodine-131 in their thyroid, they pump a lot more iodine into and it flushes that out. It's a known treatment. Anyways, this is the only nuclear reactor accident to have ever caused death to civilians and humans. Three Mile Island was a nothing burger. Fukushima was a stupid bunch of situations, but nobody died of radiation. The only people who died from Fukushima were 2,000 people who died because of the evacuation. They took 7 intensive care wards and put them into gymnasiums where they had no ventilators or anything. They had nothing. So many of them died. Well, 2,000, that's quite a few. But nobody died from radiation, and the Radiation Effects Research Foundation, which is based in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, formed after the war by MacArthur and the Japanese. It's a joint American-Japanese research facility. The head of that said it's no use studying this for people because nobody got exposed to anything like a level of radiation that could cause harm amongst even the workers at the reactor. The United States has 98, I believe, operating nuclear reactors today. No one has ever been injured by a nuclear reactor in 60-odd years in the commercial fleet, never mind killed. And yet they act as though this is some kind of great threat to our health and life. 1.6 million people die in road accidents from moving vehicles, including pedestrians and cyclists and drivers. 1.6 million annually, compared to none from nuclear energy since Chernobyl. And 11 countries produce more than 33% of their electricity from nuclear energy. The most important fact to know, which is never mentioned by the anti-nuclear people, is that France, with nearly 70% of its electricity from nuclear, has just over half the CO2 emissions per capita of Germany. In other words, you can cut your CO2 emissions in half by having 70% of your electricity produced by nuclear power in a Western country. That's a pretty important fact, I would think. Nobody talks about it. This is just the energy share showing that fossil fuels are responsible for more than 80%. 82% is the number that's used these days. And that this is what they're for: industrial, transportation, residential, and commercial. Globally, buildings use nearly 40% of all energy consumption for heating, cooling, hot water, lights, and appliances. All of those are stationary uses that could be supplied by nuclear energy easily. About 60% or more of electricity is produced by fossil fuels. All of the buildings could be serviced with nuclear energy. In fact, everything which is stationary that needs heat or electricity can be served by nuclear energy. We have now eliminated at least 50% of the fossil fuels being used today. Not because CO2 is dangerous. It is, you'll see in a minute, one of the most important things there is on the whole planet for life, perhaps the most important. But because conserving fossil fuels for the uses that you can't do with anything else is really important, especially aircraft, that's the main one, and other, like, heavy mining trucks coming up out of open pit mines around a circle. You're not going to do that with batteries with 300 tons of ore in them. So there are things that need fossil fuels, but they are a small fraction of what we're doing with them today. The whole thing about cars all being run on batteries, though, at this point in time, is ludicrous. There isn't enough metals to do it. There's not enough you can't make enough batteries to do that. And wind and solar, I think Alex is going to ask me about that later, because it's so ridiculous, it's not even worth talking about hardly, but got to talk about it. All shipping can be nuclear powered, even though it is a form of transport, because transport is where there's certain things you can't do, like airplanes. But with nuclear propulsion, 5 Soviet icebreakers in the Arctic breaking ice with nuclear propulsion. If you can go underwater in a submarine for 3 months with 100 nuclear missiles on nuclear propulsion, I think we can do cargo ships and oil tankers. And the nuclear navies of 6 countries produce a lot of people who know how to run nuclear propulsion that could be picked up even stronger and make more people know how to do that. These are safe propulsion systems. You haven't seen a situation where the nuclear propulsion system was responsible for a problem with shipping. All trains can be electrified and run on nuclear energy. All trains, by electrifying the track. So there you go. All those things can be run on nuclear energy, which would probably go to 60 to 70% of fossil fuel reduction. And yet, people are against nuclear energy. Meanwhile, Russia, India, and China are building them. We saw today the numbers for China, I think. They've got 74 under construction or planned. Every nuclear reactor you build lets you export more of your fossil fuels to some crazy country that doesn't build them. Right? Speaking of crazy countries. I'm a Canadian, so I can say that. I'm afraid our country is just as crazy. This is the rise of CO2 in the global atmosphere. And the only real thing we know that CO2 is doing for sure is 2 different things that have to do with plants. Plants need CO2 to exist. That is their food. And they are our food. So all life needs CO2 to exist. And CO2, as I showed earlier, went down to the lowest level in the history of the Earth at 180 ppm. And by the time we started measuring at Mauna Loa, it had come back to about 300 or so, little more, and has continued to go up to now about 420. This is resulting in the greening of the Earth. This is a NASA website, an international team of 32 authors from 24 institutions in 8 countries, clearly shows the positive effect of more CO2 in the global atmosphere. This was where it was first broken in 2014 by the CSIRO in Australia, where they studied this. And you can see, interesting here, this really shows that the greening occurs more in the drier areas than it does in the wetter areas. It results in a larger increase in growth in the dry areas. That's because increased CO2 not only gives the plants more food to grow faster, but it also makes them more efficient with water, because now they don't have to have so many holes under their leaves, called lenticels, to absorb the CO2 into themselves, and therefore they lose less water, because that's where the water comes out. So they become much more efficient with water and can grow in areas where they could never grow before, and in the dry areas where they're growing now, they flourish even more. This is India and China. They have resulted... Gee, I'm sorry, I missed this one too. When you go from keynote to PowerPoint, sometimes it gargles the... chops the in the in message. China and India have contributed more to the greening of the earth than any other countries in the world. They have planted more new forests than any other countries in the world combined. Their crop production is larger than anywhere else in the world because they have more people to feed than anywhere else in the world. And therefore, they are the two greenest nations on earth today. Time for questions. I'm almost there. This is what greenhouse growers do. They purposely pay to put more CO2 to greatly increase plant growth and productivity in their greenhouses. Yeah, I'm only 2 slides away. Just want to say here, fossil fuels are 100% organic, as in the chemical, the scientific meaning of organic, as in organic chemistry, which is the chemistry of carbon, in other words, the chemistry of life. All other chemistry of other elements is inorganic chemistry. All fossil fuels were produced with solar energy from photosynthesis, combining H2O and CO2, and when burned, produce the primary foods for life, H2O and CO2. It's the largest storage battery of solar energy on Earth. And I just added this last slide, which came to me today, just sort of popped in my head. That kind of works, doesn't it? There you go. Thank you. I don't know if I should even say that. It seems to me if Putin gets word that I said that, he might send somebody after me.
A few minutes of Q&A with Alex Epstein. Alex, welcome back.
Come on, Alex. I'm sorry if I carried on too long, but I just can't help it.
So Patrick told me in advance he had a good Ukraine joke, and I didn't believe him, but he was right. So just one quick administrative note. Some of you may have noticed these very attractive and attention-getting I Love Fossil Fuels pins that I'm wearing and others are wearing. And the good news is you can get your own. They are outside on the table over there, so you just take one. Maybe take a couple. And also, if you want, there are forms that you can fill out to get on my Energy Talking Points mailing list, where you'll get just amazing, concise, powerful talking points on all the latest issues. All right, so we have questions. If you have any new ones, submit them now. Otherwise, I'm going to forget you. But so we got a lot of good stuff. But I'm going to ask one myself first. So you know, one of the things I really appreciate about Patrick is he has this amazing curiosity, I think even reflected by the fact that he was in all the sessions today thinking about it. And I'm just curious, like, where does that come from? And also, how do you keep it going over time, like being a lifelong learner? Because I
I really admire that, and I'm curious how to get more of it myself.
I have a deep lust for logic and information. I really like to know how the world works. I like to understand cause-effect relationships and the difference between them and not cause-effect situations, which is the key to science. I mean, science is a process. They talk about the science as if it's a thing. But science is actually the process of discovery that begins with observation. That's why the fake invisible catastrophes and remote things, they use those things to trick us, because they can't see it. They can't see the CO2, they can't see the radiation, they can't see the polar bears, they can't see the coral reefs. So they're easily tricked into believing these scare stories, because for some reason people want to believe in the danger of the future. And so they burn witches at one time, and now they call us climate deniers. That's a better outcome, as far as I can see. And I just have a thirst for knowledge. It consumes me to really understand that, because it starts with observation, it continues on to verification, where the observer makes sure it wasn't a fluke by repeating it over and over again in their own lab or wherever, and then it goes to replication, where they let it out to the general science community to see if they can produce the same result as you did, and if they can, you have a hypothesis which may become a theory. It's as simple as that. Methodology usually takes up about 3/4 of a science article, and that's usually about trying to figure out how to keep the other variables from influencing the two things you're trying to see how are related with each other. But the fundamental process is observation, verification, replication. And in that sense, it's a very simple procedure. But people confuse science with policy all the time now. As a matter of fact, I think they think policy should drive science. And that's what's happening. The silent part of this whole conspiracy is the politicians funding the scientists. All the climate science is coming from politicians, not from private corporations who actually are trying to make something better that people might want. But what the politicians want is a scare story that they can put fear. You're driving down the highway in your SUV, you're afraid you're killing your grandchildren. That makes you feel guilty, so you open your wallet and send Greenpeace a big check. The megaphone is the media and the activists. They take these, you know, studies which start with something like, a new study suggests, as if suggests is a scientific word. And just watch out for that sort of stuff, because they're always trying to pull the wool over your eyes with these things. There is no hard evidence that CO2 has any role in the warming period that we've been in since 1700. I'm not saying it might not have some influence, but it isn't very important, because it isn't going in an exponential curve or anything like that. Michael Mann and his hockey stick is total fakery. But because we've seen what's really happening. That's my excuse for being so inquisitive.
Follow up on that, and this incorporates another question, is, you know, it seems like a very stark contrast to others, like the genuine interest in cause and effect wherever that leads. What I usually see is a pseudo interest in cause and effect designed to advance people's agendas. So, like, hypothetically, if someone wants to understand why an almond farmer leaves California, they want to do it to say, oh, CO2 is screwing everything up versus California's regulations are screwing everything up. Are there any other ecologists or life scientists like you who are really interested in cause and effect wherever it leads, whether we're at fault for something or not? Because I would love to read them.
And then the related question is, you've been saying some new stuff that's not even in your latest book, so are you working on a new book?
So we want people like you, and then are you going to write us a new book?
No. I'm going to update my book titled Trees Are the Answer, which was my first book, which was before the electronic age, and so it was only in a paperback printed in Hong Kong. But it sold about 50,000 copies amongst the forest industry, and it is a book which balances preservation with forestry. And there's all kinds of people who are totally opposed to forestry, as if, I don't know what we're supposed to build our houses with, but and then there's people who are totally for forestry. And there is a way to bring a balance to that. One of the chapters in it, one of the early ones, is called The Comparative Aesthetics of Landscapes. People think that a wheat field blowing in the wind is beautiful with the sun on it, when in fact it's a totally deforested area with exotic plants. Whereas if they look at a recent clear cut, they think it's ugly and horrible and destructive, when in fact all the seeds of all the plants that were growing in there are waiting to germinate in the ground and put a new forest up. It's just the way the world works. So beauty is in the eye of the beholder, is part of all of that. And people have incorrect judgments from the aesthetics of what they see. We don't like jumbled up messes, but nature is best as a jumbled up mess rather than being a pavement. People think a asphalt parking lot with nice yellow lines on it looks prettier than a clear cut. And there's nobody chaining themselves to the trucks that are dumping the asphalt on the land to build a highway. They're chaining themselves to a tree somewhere. So it's all about that sort of thing. And what I say is that trees are the answer to a lot of questions about our future on this planet, ranging from the most practical as to what is the most sustainable and renewable thing to build our homes with, to how can we conserve biodiversity, which lives in forests. Most of the species live in forests either full-time or sometime. And how can we have clean water and clean soil and clean air? Forests clean the air, they clean the water, they strain the water, they make the dirt. People think trees eat the soil. No, the trees made the soil. They're not consuming it. They are making it. They're consuming the CO2 from the atmosphere and the water from the rain and the nitrogen from the bacteria that bring it from the air as well. And a few of the minerals that have come from the rocks. That's called the parent material in soil formation, soil science. And it's just a magical situation if you see it that way. And then it goes all the way to the most aesthetic of how can we make the earth more green and beautiful, and trees are the answer to that in many ways too. So that's what I'm doing. And then the next thing I'm going to do is a photo book of my journey around the world through Greenpeace times and all the times I've been overseas to Indonesia and the coral reefs and the jungles of Brazil and the falls. How many of you have seen the Foz do Iguaçu on the Argentina-Brazil border? One, two, go there. There's nothing more beautiful in the world. There's monkeys in the trees, there's birds everywhere, and it has no high rises. You go to Niagara Falls and there's 17 casinos like in your backdrop that you can't even find a place to take a picture of it hardly. But Foz do Iguaçu is a massive, the most romantic, the most beautiful waterfalls in the world. And it's easy to get to. And it's worth seeing as the coral reefs in Indonesia, and you don't have to go underwater if you don't want to do that.
I'm looking, yeah, well, I would love maybe a subset of like the Patrick Moore travel guide.
It'll be a bit like that.
Amazing. Okay, I don't know how many more I have. I'm going to ask at least one more, which I think is an overarching question that someone has asked, is should we even be worried about the rise of CO2? I've heard you say in an interview that you expect in the future that we will need to add CO2 to the atmosphere
to sustain life.
The opinion I have on that is we are adding it faster than we need to. We've already got it up to 420, which has really increased the growth rate, and we're not going to stop putting CO2 into the atmosphere. But reducing the fossil fuel consumption down to, say, even 20% of what it is now, saving it for the future. Let me give you a clear example. Coal can be made into liquid fuel for transportation. That would be its most valuable use in the final analysis. You can't put coal in a pipe, whereas you can put liquid fuels and gas, like natural gas, in a pipe. But you can't put coal in a pipe. So liquid is really important. Sasol in South Africa, because they had no fossil fuels except coal, has built this massive place where they're turning coal into liquid fuel. But they're using coal as the energy source for the process, So they only end up with one-third of the coal being turned into liquid fuel because they have to use heat to make the coal hot, and then they have to get hydrogen from another third of the coal to hydrogenize the remaining coal and end up with a third being turned into liquid. With high-temperature nuclear reactors, you can get 100% of the coal turned into liquid fuel. And that would be far more important because we don't need coal for stationary power. We can use nuclear for that. We could replace every coal plant with a nuclear plant and end up with 4,000 nuclear plants instead of 440, which is what we have now. And that's what we should do. And even putting 20% of the CO2 we're putting into the atmosphere now would cause it to rise continuously, almost although slower than it is now. There's no emergency now like there was when it went down to 180, where 150 is the death of plants. The oceans warmed coming out of the last glaciation, the most recent glaciation. The word last can be interpreted as final, but there's no reason to believe that that was the final glaciation. It was the most recent glaciation out of 45 or so. And so we have started on a trajectory now where we have saved life from a certain demise due to lack of CO2 with the continuation of that 150 million year downturn. And just as the shellfish didn't mean to suck the CO2 out of life, they were making armor for themselves. We didn't mean to save the Earth from the death of life. We did it for energy purposes. So it's kind of cosmic. You know, both of those were inadvertent side effects of what life did, except we were the life that saved the world. And the shellfish, I don't know what we should do about those evil shellfish out there.
Yeah.
They nearly killed us.
That's true.
I think we'll have a, you know, we'll pardon them.
Yeah.
They didn't have a brain for one thing.
Do we have any more time? Okay, so let me just
say first, thank you.
Thanks, Patrick, just personally for being a great example of a pro-human scientist. I always say this to you, but I always admire it, and I know everyone else appreciates this as well. And on a personal note, I also want to thank Jennifer in particular, because she asked me months ago, like, hey, you want to do some debates? I'm like, I would love to do some debates, but nobody's going to debate me. It's going to be so hard. And she really pushed forward. I don't know how many people she had to go through to get somebody to agree to do it. I think it was mostly people who didn't know who I was, and that's why they agreed. But in any case, I don't know if it'll happen in the future, but it will. Okay, well, I am super grateful to her for making that happen. And you know, this is, I think, one of the best groups of thinkers that has ever been put together on this subject, in you know, my biased opinion. So I'm really grateful to Steamboat for doing this and also for getting all these students involved. So it's been a pleasure to participate. And thanks to all of you for coming.
Ditto.